Hey everyone, my name is Gavin Kemp, and today I am super excited Tryhard Ninja's album, Volume 2. This album is packed with awesome songs that make you want to dance and sing. What I love about this album is that it's all about gaming and having adventures. Every song feels like you're on a cool quest, fighting monsters and exploring new worlds. The lyrics are catchy and easy to remember, so you can sing along right away. My favorite song from the album is Follow Me. It's all about the teamwork and friendship, showing how important it is to stick together with your friends. The message makes you feel really good and ready to take on anything. Overall, Tryhard Ninja's Volume 2 is an amazing album for kids who love music and games. If you enjoy what ivory tunes that make you smile, this album is perfect for you. So now let's listen to Follow Me. Enjoy!
So long, a savage mask, old story from the past. He rules, rules. He said, follow me, follow, follow, follow. Over 30 years ago, when he took them down below, and tonight he walks again. So step inside, enjoy the show. Follow me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually, they'll go insane.
You never know what you will find on your radio/interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
They'll go insane. And eventually...
That's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
And I am Elizabeth Richard Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio.
Oh,
and you are?
I'm Yuri Kochiyama with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
JBD, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. By now, everybody knows what has been going on in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Twin Cities, Minnesota, the state. We know about the horrific shootings, but we may not know about the general strike, the thousands and thousands of people that have been on the streets. That has almost been blacked out when you look at least local news, which will spend an enormous amount of time telling you about some sort of crime in another city, but won't show the cameras and won't have commentary or in-depth reporting about general strikes and protests against this administration in the usage of ICE. I want to talk to independent journalist, no stranger to our airwaves. Her name is Georgia Fort. You've been on the front lines, or at least on the ground level, seeing everything. And so the first thing I want to ask is just your general thoughts on what is happening. Did you ever think what is going on now would escalate to this point, especially since you're on the ground covering everything that was happening in the aftermath of George Floyd?
What is happening in Minnesota should be a code red for America. I think maybe folks are thinking the people in Minnesota are overreacting, that we are a protest state. You could look at what happened in Chicago and it wasn't that bad, and so it's us that's escalating this. But I encourage people to look at the numbers in comparison what happened in Illinois to what's happening in Minnesota. We have half the population of Illinois, but we have double the amount of agents who are here right now. We have half the population, but we have more than double the amount of arrests that have happened in a short period of time. And we have a fraction of the amount of immigrants who actually live here. And so to see this type of occupation in a state that is, you know, primarily Democratic and did not support Trump, it to me says this isn't about immigration. When you have U.S. citizens who are being unconstitutionally arrested, their doors are being busted in. There is now a class action lawsuit that's been filed by the ACLU because it's becoming so common practice to target U.S. citizens. We have two U.S. citizens who have been brutally shot and killed in the street without even an investigation being conducted before it's considered justified. People who are not citizens no longer have access to due process. Attorneys have been denied access to see their clients illegally. Members of Congress have been denied access to see these facilities where people are being detained. There have been so many violations of not just our Constitution, but our judicial practices. The Hennepin County attorney here said that they tried to access the scene alongside state investigators at where Alex Pretty was fatally shot. They were denied access to the scene, and so they decided to go to a judge and get a warrant signed so that that would reinforce the reason why they should be able to access this scene. They get the warrant signed by a judge and they go back to the scene so that they can start collecting evidence to do an investigation, since the federal government is not going to. And the federal agents did not adhere to a judge's order. And so what does that say about law and order? What does that say about our Constitution? What does that say about our democracy? And so I think people across this country, U.S. citizens across this country, need to realize that what is happening in Minnesota is, it should be a code red for the rest of this country.
Georgia Fort, you mentioned that we're not hearing too much about Chicago and people have walked away with this sense that it wasn't that bad. Chicago had been a poster child for people saying we need the National Guard. We need some sort of federal intervention, because what we were constantly being bombarded with about Chicago was that it was a crime-ridden city. It was filled with gangs. It is mostly black people, at least a large amount of black people now. And so anything that happened in Chicago, I think in the minds of many, is justified. You know, well, it has gangs, Georgia. You know, the crime. I've seen the news, you know, that sort of thing. Minneapolis seems to be a little bit different in the sense that the two shooting victims that we know are white, and the population or the perception of the Twin Cities is that this is a white city, and the narrative has shifted from gangbangers in Washington, D.C., gangbangers in Chicago, to or anarchists in Portland, to something else. You know, I don't know exactly how it gets described, but there's definitely a lot more attention to Minneapolis, and that seems by design more than it is maybe by happenstance. And what I mean by that is that we're seeing the shooting, that's all over, but we're not seeing the massive protests, we're not seeing the resistance. And so I wanted to get your sense about that. Is this a message or a dog whistle to white folks maybe around the world, the country, that this type of violence and violation is going to be normalized? Because in our communities, folks are like, we've been seeing stuff like this. We've been seeing the Dana Golds and Alex Prentice be shot and it be justified within minutes. So this is not a new thing. It's tragic. But for a lot of other folks, they're literally clutching their pearls and going, I can't believe this is happening. And some of us are going, welcome to America. This has been our America. It was Minneapolis just 6 months, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah, you bring up an unfortunate truth, an unfortunate reality for many Black Americans in this country, is that this type of government-funded violence has been normal for so long. I do think that as Black Americans, we are going to have to deeply remember our history while also finding the context of how this moment is different. Because there are a lot of through lines, there are a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of differences. And so, yes, the parallels to 5 years ago, but I think more concerningly, the parallels to 80 years ago, when people were being lynched just because they were Black, just because they whistled, just because they breathed, just because they existed. And people were brutalized for loving those types of people. So when I think about Renee Good or Alex Pretty, white people who are putting their bodies on the line, it reminds me of the America that brutalized anyone who loved Black folks, even if they looked like they could be related to the KKK, right? We're seeing masked agents very similar to the white robes that we saw, this principle that you have to hide yourself Why do you need to hide yourself? And it's to evade the accountability for the terror that you are inflicting on this nation. And so I think, yes, there's parallels, but there's also a lot of differences because of the depth of the evil that we are currently experiencing and the seemingly inability to find any force of power through a municipality or through county government or through state government that can actually stand effectively against this. And so I think that is why people are taking a stand in the streets. And whether it's being reported on mainstream media or not, we are seeing record numbers, well over 50,000 people, I want to say, on Thursday, over 100,000 people. But why aren't they saying the amount? Why, like, when I'm seeing it on television, when I'm reading the paper, people are not contextualizing the amount of people who are standing up against this. And this has been daily. So Renee Good was killed on January 7th. Every single day since January 7th, there have been at least one protest that has happened either at the federal building or at the memorial site or at the hotels where these ICE agents are staying or downtown at the Capitol. I mean, there has been protests led by clergy. We saw more than 100 members of clergy who were arrested at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport taking a stand against the brutality that's being inflicted on this community. So people are not sitting down quiet. They're not being paralyzed by their fear. But it is really hard to say how do we move forward as a state and as a country from this moment.
Georgia Fort, I have a couple of questions, but I want you to maybe dig in a little deeper and describe for our listeners this the amount of people that have been out and whether or not that has been effective. Kind of what has trickled out has been the word general strike and tens of thousands of people out on the street. But what does that really mean? What does that do? What's been the response to it other than seeing the complicity of legacy media not really giving a reporting, a full accounting of what has happened?
It's hard to contextualize. There's definitely an economic impact. When you shut down the workforce, when taxes are not being collected, there's definitely an economic impact that is felt. When corporations can't count on your labor for their profits, they are more willing to step up. And we actually saw that this weekend. 60 CEOs signed on to a statement, at least acknowledging lightly what is happening and encouraging elected officials to work together and figure it out. It was a very soft statement, milquetoast statement. It didn't have a lot of backbone, but it was the first time since this administration was inaugurated that we have seen the corporate sector take this type of collective stance. Minnesota is home to dozens of Fortune 500 companies, which makes it very unique to have that level of corporate representation here. This is also the headquarters of or the launching pad for the national Target boycott. Nakima Levy Armstrong and Monique Cullors Doty, as well as Jelani Hussein, are the three founders of the Target boycott. And so even leading up to this moment, right, we were seeing organizers here who were leveraging economic pressure to try and get buy-in, support, protection from some of these corporations who are here. Those pleas, those desperate pleas that went on and on and on all year long before Metro Operation Surge started, they all fell on deaf ears. The CEO of Target never actually met with organizers. And so now escalating that economic boycott to a total statewide strike is now not just going to affect one corporation, it's going to affect all of them. And it's also going to affect the amount of taxes that the government can collect. And so people have stood up, they've put their bodies on the line, they've used their whistles, they've had the meetings with all their elected officials, they did the Target boycott. I mean, people are really leveraging all of their civic weapons, so to say, to try and get this situation to de-escalate. And so I think the statewide strike is going to force the hand of the corporate community, that they're going to have to move beyond these soft statements and start taking some action, start putting some pressure on this administration to back down. Our elected officials, just this past weekend, after this, this is the third shooting. It's the second fatal shooting that has happened in 3 weeks. But our governor, you know, basically asked, what is it going to take? And received a pretty quick response from Pam Bondi, who said, if you want us to remove these agents, we want to see everybody who's on SNAP and Medicaid. We want the voter rolls. So you tell me, what does this have to do with immigration, to demand the voter rolls in order to ease the tension here with these agents? The math ain't mathing, Davey.
Wow. So there's a demand for voter rolls.
And there's been a demand. There was a demand over the summer that was issued to the Secretary of State. Prior to, there was a series of things that led up to Metro Operation Surge happening here. Right before, right after the five-year anniversary of George Floyd, the federal consent decree was rolled back. Here in Minnesota, that was something that the people here had fought for. It's something that the DOJ investigated intensively after George Floyd, and they did find a pattern of discrimination in the way that MPD, the Minneapolis Police Department, had been conducting itself with residents. And so it imposed this federal consent decree, which listed all of these things that would require the local police department to become back in compliance and move past this longstanding history of being discriminatory. Well, there's federal consent decrees on several police departments across the country, but why was the one in Minnesota rolled back?
Wow.
Just before all of this happened, right? There was a demand for the voter rolls prior to Operation Metro Surge. So I think there needs to be some research on these operations that are being targeted specifically at states that are primarily Democratic. And go back and see, is this the prerequisite? Is this what's happening in all of the cases? If you look at Chicago, was there a demand for the voter rolls before they actually went and started to occupy the state? Were those voter rolls ever handed over? Is that why things started to de-escalate? Because there, I think they've only done 1,500 arrests in like 3 or 4 months. Here, we've had 12,000 arrests. And they've only been here for a month.
12,000 arrests. Who did they arrest?
They, what they'll tell you is they've arrested a lot of criminals, the worst of the worst. But I've heard countless stories of U.S. citizens being arrested. I've heard countless stories of people who are going through the naturalization process legally, who don't have a criminal record, being arrested. I mean, it is really unfathomable, honestly.
Right. Let me just make sure people understand, because I think when you say you heard, right, it kind of makes it seem like, well, who's she? No, this is an award-winning journalist, very well known in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area, and an independent journalist. So you have a lot of room to maneuver and see things that maybe there, it seems like there's a lot of constraints on your contemporaries that are not under the guise of independence. And I wanted to see if maybe you could talk a little bit about that. You know, have you heard from, you know, folks in legacy media? What are they telling you? Is there a reason why they are not maybe even mentioning some of the things that you just mentioned? You know, the voter roll, you know, askings and they're not telling how big the crowds are, not talking about the economic impacts and all these other things, or even doing a deep dive into actually who's being arrested. We heard that the reason for coming to Minneapolis, St. Paul, was because there was a bunch of folks of Somali descent who have been castigated as being criminal, fraudulent, all these, you know, negative things. And then we saw a bunch of videos with Somalis saying they voted for Trump and that, you know, that they're not that. And then it just kind of disappeared. That narrative about Somalis is gone. You know, about the closest thing we heard is that Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel said he was going to recognize a fraction, you know, a rebel faction in Somalia and say, we're going to recognize Somaliland and set up shop there. And that's it. We haven't heard anything else. At this point, it's been about the protests. And as you pointed out, American citizens being arrested in this case, shot twice. And a third one, I think, was just happening. But fortunately, that person didn't die.
Why whoever has those narratives about the fraud in the Somali community here in Minnesota, why don't they tell you that the ringleader of the biggest fraudulent operation was a white woman? Why do they leave that part out?
Yeah.
Why is that the part that never makes the story? And so I think that people have to realize that if
we're talking about a small amount of people anyway. Not thousands of people in a community. So that's important to note.
and needless to say, I mean, that fraud has been addressed through the justice system. The people who are found guilty of fraud are in jail. Right. That's the last time I checked, that is the way in which fraud is supposed to be dealt with, right? And how does things spill over if fraud then now incriminates every Somali person? The last time I checked, that is racial discrimination. You know, that is a discriminatory practice. And so I think information is being weaponized in this season to incite fear and to justify terror that's being inflicted on our country, to justify the constitutional violations of our people. And so... Right. If we tolerate this, right, the tolerance, and this is what Black Americans have been saying the entire time, is we've had our civil rights violated and it's justified. We've had our constitutional rights violated and it's been justified. And so that is what set the stage for what we're experiencing right now. When we decided as a country to stay quiet about the 300 journalists who were killed covering what was happening in Palestine, we set the stage for our American journalists to be arrested, to be brutalized, right?
Right.
And so our silence in this moment is complicity. We cannot be neutral about the dismantling of our democracy and still expect to be protected by it. If you want your children to inherit an America that has any semblance of freedom, that has any semblance of a constitution or constitutional or civil rights that protect them from being lynched like our ancestors were, then you better get up and say something, do something, call an elected official, start deploying some type of strategies of resistance, because what we are experiencing and what we're witnessing, what we're observing, what we're documenting, what I'm documenting as a journalist here on the ground, is that this administration is just going to keep pushing the boundaries as far as they can.
Hmm. Are they kicking indoors in Minneapolis, St. Paul?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is.
And what's been the response to that? We've heard that, but we haven't necessarily seen that in action. So what is that?
I'll be glad to send some links. There is a man who perceivably just looks like a regular, you know, African-American man. But I guess, you know, he's from Liberia, but he hasn't been there since he was 6 or 7. He's now almost 40. They used, you know, one of those big...
battering rams.
Yes, to plow through his door where his family was, his wife was. And they detained him. They sent him to Texas. and then ended up bringing him back here, releasing him, then re-arresting him just to find out it was all a mistake, and then re-releasing him again, all without actually having a warrant.
Wow.
His name is Garrison. There is another U.S. citizen, elderly Hmong man, same exact tactics. They plowed his door down, broke in, pulled him out. He's also a U.S. citizen. And so it is becoming more frequent that we're seeing this. And to be able to leverage that type of force even without a warrant also says a lot. It's hard to articulate, you know, and I was in a conversation with an attorney, and I was sharing some of these observations, some of these patterns that I'm observing as I'm reporting on the facts of this, and saying the ACLU has filed this class action lawsuit because there's so many violations against U.S. citizens. Immigration attorneys are saying that they're being illegally being denied access to their clients. Immigration attorneys saying their clients are not being afforded due process. Our county attorney saying that they went and got a signed judicial order to access the scene to be able to investigate what happened to Alex Pretty, denied access. All of these violations of our Constitution and our civil liberties and our judicial processes, and no one's doing anything about it. And then when you have people like me who are showing folks the patterns, then I am that sounds like I'm advocating by just restating the facts. When did the truth become so political? When did humanity become so political? When did our constitution, when did our constitutional rights become negotiable?
Right. Well, you're talking about some things, Georgia Ford is our guest, that I think in quote-unquote normal times would make sense. There are lawsuits, there's, you know, proof that constitutional rights are being violated, all the things that you just laid out. But you're now dealing with a power structure that doesn't care and is saying that we're going to rewrite the rules, that we don't think a constitution is feasible and practical at this point in time. We want a monarchy type government. We're going to change it. And yeah, you're right, George. We're doing these things. What are you going to do about it? And so that
and
becomes the thing. Right.
With immunity.
Mm-hmm. So now, at this point, what does one do? Because, yeah, you can get a court order. I'm not going to listen to it. You know, you can tell me I'm violating the Constitution. Yeah, you're damn right I am. And I'm going to keep doing that. You have a governor. You have municipalities that, in theory, should stand up to these folks. And let me just give an example. When we had COVID, we saw all around the country, including here in California, people pick up armed, you know, went armed to state capitals, stood around by the hundreds talking about we ain't wearing no mask. And they brought those guns, presumably, to fight back anybody who would step to them and say, no, you're going to wear these masks and all that. Remember that? I mean, they did it in Michigan. They threatened to kidnap the governor. They came to California. They were all over the country doing that. And you had folks saying, well, that's the American way. They have a right to protest. Now, here, we're not seeing that sort of leeway or that sort of encouragement, one. And two, we're seeing now, arguably, some of those people who probably were in those state capitals might be the ones wearing the ICE, you know, uniforms today. And so they're acting with impunity. And I'm looking and I'm saying, you didn't resist when these folks went up on the state capitol, and now you're not resisting when constitutional rights are being violated. What good is your governor? What good is your mayor? What good is the local police force or anybody else that's supposed to be able to be a buffer between, you know, federal tyranny and how it impacts the citizens and, you know, ordinary people? They're not, that seems like everybody's missing from action.
if we survive this moment, the people who are missing from action, those are the people American citizens really need to think about, replacing if we survive this moment.
You don't think we will?
I don't know. I'm a deeply spiritual person, and so I'm fasting and praying. I am fasting and praying because my God is bigger than all of them. In the flesh, and so I'm trying to walk by my faith and not by my sight. It is going to require Americans to get serious. What's happening in Minnesota has to be a code red for America.
And here we are thinking that Super Bowl's in a couple of weeks, getting my popcorn and everything together. Nobody's talking about the fact that you all canceled a basketball game. You know, and that basketball game was filled with, you know, people came to that stadium, you know, to protest.
If the nation can shut down because of COVID, and that was a government mandate, the nation can self shut down because it's in a state of emergency. There are solutions. There are things that can be done about it, but it requires your time, your attention, your focus. It requires strategy. It requires you to work with people, maybe even people you disagree with. But we are not going to survive this moment if people just continue with business as usual and say, well, it's not my problem. Well, it's not happening here. Well, because it's of the fraud. Well, it's because she blew the whistle. Well, it's because he didn't comply. Well, it's because there was a mix up with the paperwork. Well, it's because, I mean, if we're just going to use excuses all the way through every single violation, then what's going to be the excuse when your rights are violated? What's going to be the excuse when our children no longer have the constitutional freedoms that we had? And so if we are going to survive this moment, it is going to require the world, it is going to require the country to see what's happening in Minnesota as a code red moment for the country.
As we get ready to let you go, Georgia Ford, let me ask you this. You mentioned about the clergy that was arrested at the airport for coming in, and then we had the protest about the clergyman who is an ICE agent, an ICE field agent. How do we reconcile with that sort of situation? People who brought that up, you know, they found themselves being arrested for protesting, and yet clergy who just are showing up to sow support and shine a light on these types of injustices, they get arrested and you don't hear anything about that.
I think that we have to remember people like Dr. King was arrested 29 times. John Lewis was arrested multiple times, as recent as October 2013 at an immigration protest. Rosa Parks was arrested. Some of the most significant people who represented change in their time did it even at the expense of their own freedom. Slavery was legal at one time. The people who started talking about abolishing slavery, they were radical, they were criminalized, they were controversial, right? And so I think that we are at a time where we are seeing a conflict between people's spiritual beliefs, their morality, and the way in which law is or is not being upheld in this moment.
Right.
The thing I think a lot of people need to know about Nakima Levy Armstrong, who is being charged as one of the organizers, is she's also a reverend. She's a deeply spiritual person. The press conference that we filmed right after that protest, she said, "My Christianity informs my activism." And so What would you do if you are a spiritual leader who felt convicted to stand up against the way in which Christian nationalism is being weaponized, or in the way in which it's weaponizing Christianity against communities of color? And not even just communities of color, because we've seen the death of two white people behind all of this, right? And so as a journalist, it is not my job to agree or disagree with people's actions. It is my job to document. And oftentimes, as an independent journalist, there are a lot of nuances and complexities that I can amplify that's left out of mainstream media. And so when I saw the way in which that story specifically was being portrayed to the world, I really feel like, you know, people portray, you know, elevated her as a civil rights attorney, but left out the fact that she's also a person who's a leader at her church.
Real talk. And, you know, as we close out, just remembering that he was under the guise of a Bible and a cross and the label of religion, that slavery was justified, segregation was justified, and all this type of oppression was justified, and weaponized, I guess we should say as well. And, you know, to quote the late Ameri Baraka, he said the God that the slave master prayed for was very different than the God that those who were enslaved were praying for. And that's the dividing line that we're dealing with right now. How do people follow your work? What can we do to support? Any marching orders you want to give our listeners?
Oh, thank you. People can find me online. I'm on all social platforms as Georgia Fort. You can also head over to my website, georgiafort.com.
There you have it. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, rocking on your radio. Hard Knock, rocking on your radio. Hard Knock, rocking on your radio. Power to the people, revolution to the people, speaking truth to power.
KVD, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Few things. First of all, a big shout out to our earlier guest, Georgia Fort, independent journalist, award-winning independent journalist, breaking down what is going on in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And we want to continue that conversation with two guests that need no introduction. First, you know him, you love him, you know him from the organization Courage, George Galvis. And there's big doings happening here in the Bay Area tomorrow in solidarity with the general strike and everything that's been going on in Minnesota, in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area. Joining us from St. Paul is an author, Walter Gleason, author, artist. He did the graphic novel, The History of Hip Hop. And as you were saying, Walter, things are changing by the minute. A third person has been shot is what I'm hearing. And things are showing no signs of slowing down. So a couple of things. Let me start off with you, Walter, just to get a sense of what have you been seeing in St. Paul, and then let me, you know, bring it over to George.
I appreciate you. So thank you for the time to be here. I'll try and do this real quick. So it's been just about not quite 3 weeks since Renee Good was shot. I heard about this about an hour and a half, 2 hours after it had happened, before any news broke. My activist networks out here have been preparing for over a year for this kind of attack, but it was scaled beyond anything else we anticipated. After she was shot, we expected that there might be a chance that they'd take a breath and kind of reevaluate, but no, they expanded, emphasized, flooded the city. A lot of the work I did was initially around St. Cloud, where there were no local defense networks in place. And so people were being taken by the dozen off the street in the first weekend. The next week was just about getting everybody up and prepared statewide and getting the country to pay attention. Mass media didn't pay attention at all, trying to get independent journalists, investigative journalists to start to kind of change the momentum. And that led up to the planning for the general strike for the 23rd. And that was the second week. And so this what I have to say at the core of it is, as horrifying as you might see something online, you're not seeing the power of the people on the street across the state. You're not seeing, you know, you might just see something on a block in Minneapolis. I was glad we were able to drive a neo-Nazi out of here who came up from Florida. But like, there are those flashpoints. We're doing this every minute of every day, providing food, providing medicine, providing extra physical defense support, which of course has led to these shootings recently, is that we're not backing down. And that's the piece that for me is most inspiring, is that thinking how rare it is for an entire community, for an entire city, an entire state to stand up together. And that's what I'm hoping we can rally up folks. I was just out in the Bay Area in the last week, and that's what brought me into contact with Dave. And so that's what I'm trying to do, is to get more people around the country to organize the way we're organized here in Minnesota.
How many people would you say came out, and what was the impact of the general strike? A couple of things is that, one, when it's reported, they don't give any numbers. You know, at this point, I think it's safe to say that mainstream media is pretty complicit in the agenda, carrying out the agenda of this current administration, to the point that maybe that is by design, that you don't even tune into the news anymore. I don't, you know, I mean, I just rely upon what we do at the station and, you know, independent networks. But with that being said, what did we miss? What carried the day that needs to be shared?
Yeah, so when you saw the footage about Minneapolis and to a lesser extent St. Paul, you're definitely getting 100, 125, maybe even 150,000 people that were that main media, mass media covered. But beyond that, statewide, you're talking about, you know, better part of 20 towns and cities that have been under assault that also rallied up. So it's at least double that number statewide. You're talking about 200,000. And then the most impactful thing for me was during that week of organizing, we tried to get people across the country to stand up and protest as well. And we have over 200 documented protests outside of Minnesota that were in solidarity with the general strike. And it lays the foundation for what we're doing now, is to expand it and to make it a regular occurrence that there are these disruptions until we get the legal constraints imposed and really functionally get this infrastructure torn down, that this administration cannot continue these activities in the years ahead.
Appreciate that. George, let me, first of all, I want you to let everybody know about what is happening tomorrow here in the Bay Area.
So absolutely in solidarity with all our relations in Minnesota, Makoche, you know, occupied territories of our Dakota and Anishinaabe relatives, you know, we are holding a an action. We are mobilizing at Shuchin Park. You know, Shuchin is also the traditional name of our areas, of Oakland, you know, Emeryville, Berkeley, you know, San Leandro, you know, a good part of the East Bay, you know, Alameda County. But it's the traditional village of, you know, of our Mwekmaloni territory, you know, relatives. It's occupied, unceded, you know, territory. So we're going to be meeting at Shuchin Park, and in the spirit of our relations there and the general strike that's happening, you know, it, you know, we're trying to ignite some scaled up activity here, right here in the Bay, man. So, you know, Target store is about 6 minutes away from Shuchin Park, as is Home Depot. So let's just say we're going to get it started at Shuchin, and we'll see what happens from there, man. Yeah, so we're mobilizing, asking folks to come out 6 p.m. Also, you know, as indigenous people, for us, our culture, our faith is always what kind of, you know, what leads us. You know, we will have our traditional singers and dancers, you know, ground us in a prayerful way. And, you know, this is an action of cultural resistance and affirmation and land back.
I want to ask you a question, George, and then I'll toss it over to Walter. There seems to be a lot of gaslighting. And gaslighting in the sense that we're being told, it may be being distracted or watching a narrative be presented a particular way, and it leaves out this larger body of things that are going on. So, for example, we're talking about Minneapolis, St. Paul. A lot of attention is focused around the two people who were killed, Renee Good and Alex Pretis. In that sort of conversation, we forget a few things. One, that since events like Standing Rock, there's been not only an escalation to clamp down on protests, but there's been laws put in the books, punishment being handed out, folks facing, you know, decades in jail for just protesting. And these were things that were going on way before this administration jumped in, but it kind of went underneath the radar. But it seemed like they were ironing it out, getting things into place, and now you have an apparatus to say, yeah, if you protest, you're somehow a domestic terrorist. That's a huge escalation. And so that's one thing that we're kind of forgetting, that, you know, just even doing what is planned tomorrow and what is going on in other cities is resulting in folks being looking at felony charges. We've almost forgotten about a year ago that folks were crossing the bridge, and 78 people are charged with felonies, or at least, you know, so high crimes. You can correct me if I'm wrong, George, just around Palestine. So that's one thing. The other gaslighting is that we kind of forget that a lot of people are being caught up in this. So, you know, with prior to the killing of Renee and Alex, we were being told that our Somalian brothers and sisters were criminal, they're fraudulent, they're all these, you know, negative things, and we just kind of focused on the Somalians, and we forgot about the Central Americans, the Mexicans, and everybody else who were being sent away to foreign countries and being put into jail. We've also forgotten that, you know, it's coming back full circle around the laws that were coming out of the Standing Rock protests, is that indigenous folks are being swept up. And as we speak, we have a number of indigenous folks that are being held incarcerated with an administration that has now switched the ideology, and they talk about real Americans, the white Americans and Christian Americans, and somehow everybody else is a foreigner, even in their own land. So let me get your thoughts and takes on that, and what we kind of need to really flesh out, George, and then I'll bring that question over to Walter, because, you know, we also forget Minneapolis has a very huge, you know, indigenous population, and I would imagine they're being caught up in this dragnet as well, and those stories aren't being amplified.
Now, absolutely. What folks may not realize is that the Twin Cities is the birthplace of the American Indian Movement. You know, and John Trudell of the American Indian Movement, you know, once said, "America's not broken; it's finishing." You know, with what it pretended to be, and I think that's what we're experiencing right now. And so, you know, many, you know, lots of love, prayers, energy to the families, and you know, to the spirits of Alex Preddy and Renee Good, you know, who really, you know, followed in the legacy of those white accomplices in the freedom struggle, like John Brown. But, you know, ISIS killed 9 people in 2026, and we know the names of the 2 white folks they've killed. But, you know, ISIS also killed a brother of African descent named Keith Porter, a Cambodian named Parity La, you know, and 5 migrant indigenous folks named, you know, Heber Sanchez Dominguez, Victor Manuel Diaz, Luis Beltran, Yanes Cruz, Luis Gustavo Nunez Caceres, and Gerardo Lunas Campos, right? So at this rate, ICE is on pace to kill more than 100 people this year. So, you know, that's why we're demanding, like, you know, one of the most disappointing things about this, man, is how weak the Dems are, you know, and those centrists who say that basically ICE just needs better training, that they just need cameras, when the call at this point, it should be absolutely crystal clear, no uncertain terms, abolish ICE. You know, we right. need to impeach Noam, impeach Trump, prosecute all those who committed these crimes and have inflicted domestic terrorism on our Black, Indigenous, and communities of color.
People forget that when people were talking about defund the police, the other phrase that went along with it was abolish ICE, and that's part of that framing and gaslighting that people forget. It's like, wait, why didn't they call for the abolishment of ICE? Dude, they've been said that, you know, from Jump Street. And the other gaslighting is now you're seeing folks go, well, Obama, you know, he deported people, and, you know, and so did George Bush, and so did every other president. Why were there no protests? And I'm sitting there to the point, like, Wait a second. I was down in Los Angeles when there were a million people out in 2006, right? We did entire shows from there. I remember the Dreamwalkers. I remember, you know, folks like yourselves and others going pretty hard at the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. If there's any difference, the one thing that I'll just point out, it didn't cost him $192 billion to do all this deporting. Not that the deporting is good, but, you know, they're saying, well, Obama deported more than than Donald Trump, so why are we complaining? It didn't cost him $192 billion to do that and all the carnage and craziness that we're seeing. So, you know, any thoughts on just that aspect alone?
Yeah, I mean, we pushed up on the Obama administration. We called him the deporter in chief and pointed out and illustrated the great betrayal, because his, you know, he was successfully elected overwhelmingly because of his support by the Brasa community, those who were the main targets of those deportations. And so, folks of African indigenous descent, you know what I mean, who are labeled quote unquote Latinx, right? So, you know, but one thing I wanted to point out, even going back to your earlier question, you know, in terms of just the strong indigenous presence in the Twin Cities, is, you know, that ICE detained and has continued to hold hostage, you know, four members of the Oglala Sioux tribe from a homeless encampment in Minneapolis, right? And they were trying to demand a ransom from the Oglala Sioux tribe, to sign these agreements to allow them to come on the reservation to cooperate with all these ridiculous demands, you know what I mean, to basically bend the knee, similar to what we've seen them do to the universities. And we've seen, you know, these academic institutions like Columbia and others who have actually submitted to that, you know, similar to the way they had the tech titans bend the knee, you know what I mean? And so, you know, indigenous people already face disproportionate rates of homelessness in a land that is our traditional homelands, that were rooted to by our indigenous ancestors, right? And tribal citizens are citizens. Homeless citizens are citizens. You know what I'm saying? So, it's absolutely ridiculous in this day and age that they're being detained for what? I mean, we know that being houseless is criminalized in this nation, but what exactly is the legal or constitutional rationale? I mean, as much as they're trying to rationalize the irrational, defend the indefensible, to hold indigenous people in these ICE detention centers, you know what I'm saying? It defies logic of any kind, right? That's one of the things I wanted to kind of lift up as well, you know what I mean? The other thing I think that's important to point out, Davey, is that, you know, we've used a lot of language, and I've certainly have, comparing the U.S. to, comparing this certainly to the Hitler regime, to Nazism. But what people forget is actually, like, that's not really, like, the U.S. doesn't have to look to anybody else's history to equate what ICE is like. Like, what Hitler actually did is he learned from the United States and the genocide of indigenous peoples to basically, right, you know, do what he did. You know what I'm saying? And so the U.S. needs to remember its own history, because ICE isn't necessarily the Gestapo. It's the descendant of slave patrols. It's the descendant of, you know, the indigenous child abductors from boarding, you know, for boarding schools, the descendants of Jim Crow South law enforcement, the descendant of the Knight Riders, of the cavalry, you know, who had a campaign of genocide against Native people. And that's, you know, that's what we need to recall, is that these modern day atrocities were inspired by the U.S., you know what I mean? And the same thing we're also seeing in Gaza with our Palestinian relatives. And, you know, and we can't also ignore, you know, how all of this is connected and related to the Israeli occupational forces. Like, all of this training, the treatment of Palestinian relatives is being adapted right here internally. And we are all being traded. And this is internal colonialism.
It is Hard Knock Radio. We are going to continue our conversation with our guests, George Galvis and Walter Greeson. Be sure to tune in tomorrow when we will continue our discussion about the ICE invasions in Minnesota.
Hard Knock, Hard Knock, Hard Knock Radio. Hard Knock.
Been fighting for a long time. I wanna see the sunshine cracking through the silence with a fire on my mind. Voices raised in rhythm, every step a sacred sign. We gon' rise above the fear, always backed by the divine. They're snatching families for no reason, locked in cages with no way out. Stripped of work, dignity drowned, while the rich just laugh and count. The streets feel heavy and hope gets lost in anger and disarray. But even in the darkest hour, we will rise and win the day. Gonna rise and win the day, pushing pain and fear away. Ain't no way they're gonna keep
us. Get K-Boo'd up, because it's K-Boo time. Get K-Boo'd up, because it's K-Boo time.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With help from our community, we exceeded